Welcome to the Astrophys Podcasts. My name is Brendan O'Brien, and first of all, we would like to acknowledge Australia's first astronomers, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, the traditional owners and custodians of the land we are on. This episode is produced on Yorta Yorta and Kaurna country. And we'd also like you to influence your local politicians to do more to mitigate climate change by moving from fossil fuels to renewable energy sources. We are now in our ninth year of production with over 190 fabulous interviews with top scientists from all over the world. Each month, we produce two fabulous episodes. On the first of each month, Dr. Ian Astroblog Musgrave gives us his monthly sky guide, plus a unique astrophotography challenge. Then, on the 15th of each month, we publish an interview with a leading astronomer, astrophysicist, space scientist, data scientist, telescope engineer, project manager, or particle physicist, and we discover their science journey and rare insights into how they think and conduct their amazing research into exactly how our universe works. Our audio files and transcripts are available on our website at astrophys.com. And MP3s can be freely streamed from SoundCloud, Google Podcasts, YouTube Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts. But right now, we're zooming over to Adelaide in South Australia to speak with Ian. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Brendan. How's things going?
Oh, very well, thanks, Ian. I'm looking forward to this colder weather. I'm well and truly over summer, so it's been very pleasant for the last week or two. It's been excellent and great to be speaking with you again, and I'm really looking forward to the May Sky Guide because, and I need to tell you right now that I did not win any prizes with the April Astrophotography Challenge. I missed out because I looked vainly for 12P Comet and didn't manage to find it. I've got hills all around me here, and my northwest sky has a hill in front of it, and so I had a few problems. But apart from that, it's been a great month. Tell me, Ian, what's up in the sky for the month of May?
Okay. Well, Brendan, it's going to be a jam-packed month of May. So let's give you a quick overview. The planetary action's gone to the morning skies, so you have to be up early in the morning in order to see some really nice things. Jupiter and Venus leave us as they disappear into the sun's glare, but you've got Mars, Saturn, and Mercury forming a line in the early morning skies, looking very nice. There's an occultation of Saturn, which is visible from the east coast. Comet 12P is becoming better. It's actually fading now, but it's getting higher. We've got the Eta Aquarius meteor shower, which will be quite interesting and be a good coda to the month. So as always, I'm going to start with the moon. So May the 1st is last quarter moon. So sky's getting dark and there's going to be lots of good times for faint fuzzies. May 8th is the new moon. May 15 is the first quarter moon, and May the 23rd is the full moon.
Yep.
The moon's at perigee on May the 6th, and apogee when it's furthest from the Earth on May the 18th. So the evening sky is a little bit sad. We've lost all our bright planets, and Jupiter especially, which has been our companion for many months, is gone into the horizon murk. But Comet 12P is still with us. Although it's fading from its most brilliant, magnitude 4.4, it's only fading slowly. And as it's getting higher, it's getting easier to see. And I'll talk about that more in a moment.
Okay.
But the bit that you're not going to like so much is the morning sky, where lots of fun things are happening, but it's you also have to get up very early in the morning.
Oh.
So from May the 3rd to May the 7th, the moon climbs down the ladder of planets, looking very nice indeed. Mercury is its morning's best for this year until about mid-month, and it forms a very nice lineup with Saturn and Mars. And it's even visible at astronomical twilight 90 minutes after before sunrise when the sky is fully dark early in the month. So on the 6th, as part of the moon planet ladder, the thin crescent moon is not far from Mercury. On the 10th, Mercury is it's furthest from the sun and will begin slowly sinking towards the horizon after that. Venus can theoretically be seen in the sky at civil twilight in the first week of the month, but soon lost to sight. We won't see Venus again until around mid-July.
Yep.
Now, Mars is continuing to climb higher in the twilight. In fact, it will be visible very easily in the nautical twilight and still is visible a little bit at astronomical twilight. On the 5th, the crescent moon is just above Mars, and again, it's forming a line with Saturn and Mercury. At this time, Mars is only 2 degrees, that is two finger widths from the moon, and it easily fits into the field of view of a pair of binoculars. Bit too far apart for telescopes, but it makes a nice astrophotograph early in the morning. Finally, Saturn. Saturn is climbing even higher. And remember, last month, Saturn and Mars were very close together. Saturn has left Mars behind, and it's climbing high into the morning sky, and is visible around about, from around about 2 o'clock in the morning. So on the 4th, the crescent moon is spectacularly close to Saturn. And for those of you in the eastern states, there's an occultation of Saturn. And of course, the lineup of Saturn, the moon, Mars, and Mercury is quite attractive. I'll talk about the occultation later on. And later on is now. So the occultation of Saturn actually occurs in the daytime. Now, the normal circumstances, you won't be able to see Saturn with the unaided eye during the daytime. In fact, even now, you won't be able to see Saturn with the unaided eye in the daytime. But because the moon is a very good guide, it's possible to see Saturn and the moon together in binoculars or telescopes. Now, again, even though it's visible in the daytime, you've got the sun. This makes things very dangerous. You're looking at the moon and Saturn with binoculars or telescopes. You've got to be very careful to make sure that the sun is hidden behind some large object, so you don't accidentally get a glimpse of the sun through binoculars or telescopes, which will ruin your eyesight.
Yep.
So again, Saturn's going to be very faint, but you'll still be able to see it in binoculars. It'll be a faint oval-shaped ghost. And again, in a telescope, you'll see Saturn as iconic Saturn, but it'd be a very pale, faded-out shape. So again, the occultation is only visible from the east coast and from Brisbane south. So Brisbane and Melbourne only see grazing occultations, so that the Saturn skips along the edge of the moon. This is actually quite a cool thing to see. But Canberra, Hobart, and Sydney all get to see proper occultations and places in between. So for Canberra, the Saturn disappears behind the moon at 9:01 AEST. For Hobart, it's 8:24 AEST. And for Sydney, it's 9:03 AEST.
Yep.
Brisbane sees a graze at 9:27, and Melbourne sees a graze at 8:56. So Canberra, the Saturn reappears from the dark side of the moon at 9:12, so it's not very long at all. Hobart sees it reappear from dark side about 9:16, so that's quite a long occultation, and Sydney sees it reappear around about 9:22. So if you're setting yourself up to look for this, it's in Saturday, so you don't have to worry about being at work. It's at a decent hour, but you will have to use the moon as your guide. The moon will be roughly northeast and very obvious, being a waning moon, so it'll be quite easy to see in the daylight, and you'll have to use that as your guide to find Saturn.
Nice.
And it will be nice. I've seen a daytime occultation of Saturn before, and it was quite impressive. Now, there's also an early morning occultation of Neptune for the east coast as well on Sunday, the 5th of May. But this is telescope only. It's occurring around about 3:50 AM AEST. And it's very low on the horizon, so it will be quite a challenge. So if you're feeling like getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to see an occultation of Neptune, Sunday morning is your time to do so. Back to our friend Comet 12P Pons Brooks, pining your way around the sky to find the comet, even though it's theoretically visible to the unaided eye. You're trying to see it against a relatively bright sky. And we've been using the star of Taurus to find it. So from the 1st of May to the 3rd of May, the comet's going to be within binocular distance of the star New Tauri. What you can do is sweep west from Aldebaran for about 2 binocular widths, and that should be bringing you to New Tauri and the comet as well. So the comet's magnitude 4.5 to 4.6 at this time, and it should be visible to the unaided eye, but atmospheric extinction means it's more like magnitude 5. Again, theoretically visible to the unaided eye, but it's almost certainly going to be much better in binoculars.
Well, I'll have another shot at it, Ian. I couldn't get it. I've got hills in my northwestern horizon and the moon was interfering with it. But a friend of mine, Renee Martins, lives about 30 kilometres away. He's a lovely photographer who mainly does landscapes. But he captured it and he got a really nice image. So I'm encouraged to have another shot.
Yep. As the month goes on, the comet's getting higher. It's passing from Taurus through Eridanus into Orion. So you're better off waiting until it's a bit later, around about the 18th to the 24th, when the comet's passing by Orion. So it's fading towards magnitude 6, but I'll talk about it in the astrophotography challenge. But the sight of the comet near Orion, when it'll be visible at astronomical twilight, when it's quite dark, means that it will be a very, very, very nice indeed. And it should be high enough above your hills to be able to be seen.
Very good.
I've been seeing some fantastic stuff on Facebook. So there's been some very nice images of the comet. What we're seeing, a lot of photographers, is basically telescopic images, but even some simple camera images are looking quite good. Anyway, on to the meteors. The Eta Aquarii meteor shower is one of two meteor showers which are really good from the southern hemisphere. It's debris from Halley's Comet, and it will peak on May the 5th to the 6th this year. It's probably better seeing it on the morning of the 6th. Now, the moon is almost new, so the rates will be very good, unlike last year when the moon was nearly camped out on the radium. But there may be some enhanced rates early on this year. So you may find looking from the 4th to the 7th, but remember you've got to get up early morning in the dark. But if you're getting up early morning for the moon near Saturn or the moon near Mars, you're going to be up anyway. So why not look for meteors as well?
Exactly.
And of course, Saturn is our guide to the Aquarian radiant. So Aquarius is a fairly nondescript constellation here in Australia. But Saturn will be very obvious, the bright golden object above the northeastern horizon, and just about a hand span to the north of that, or to the left, if you like, is the radiant of the Aquarians. So if you get yourself a nice comfy chair, let your eye roam around above Saturn, don't look in any one spot directly for a long time, but let your eye roam around, because meteors start burning roughly any time. So they might start burning close to the radiant, at the apparent position that the meteors appear from. They might start burning from much further away from the radiant. So let your eyes roam around and take in the sky. Of course, because, you know, you've got at least Saturn to look at, and then as the morning wears on, you'll have Mars coming up, and then finally Mercury. So it's best to look between about 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock in the morning. So again, you have to get up very early in the morning, but you'll be rewarded with some nice views of the planets as well. And you'll have Scorpius, the Scorpion, looking very good as well. So that's the meteors. And we're losing Orion as it sinks into the west. We're also gaining Scorpius, the Scorpion, which is beginning to rise in the east. And it's almost galaxy season with Sagittarius in the heart of the Milky Way rising late in the evening. Its southern cross is going to be nice and high, and the globular cluster of Vega Centauri is also going to be nice and high for you to look at. And I'll talk about this in our next broadcast.
Excellent. Now, Ian, do you want to give us a tangent now or your astrophotography challenge?
The tangent, because that feeds into the astrophotography challenge.
Yep.
Now, and of course, we start off with Comet 12P Pons Brooks, and it's been the subject of just a little bit of hype. It's been called the Devil Comet because at one stage it's used that comet to be interpreted, if you squinted very hard, as devil's horns. But Devil Comet is a lot more interesting than comet with a U-shaped coma in terms of drumming up headlines. And now it's being called the once-in-a-lifetime comet, which is basically true for most comets, except for some very, very short period comets. Now, many of us have seen the little fuzzy dot with the stubby tail, and we may be reminiscing about the huge rooster tail of Comet McNaught or the searchlight tail of Comet Lovejoy. You know, bright comets and their tails are unmistakable. So then, why did most ancient images of comets be so rubbish? For example, most famous comet depiction is the Bayeux Tapestry. In panel 32, a group of people are pointing up at a comet, thought to be Halley's Comet, the origin of the Eta Aquarius meteor shower, with the text "Isti Mirat Stella," which roughly translates to "they are marveling at the star," or you could also translate it as "amazing, a star." What is interesting is this comet is never mentioned again or referred to again in the entire tapestry. You've got one panel, look, a comet, and then everyone goes on chopping each other up. The image of the comet consists of what is recognisably a cartoon of a star, then a maypole-like arrangement and a plate of flame. It looks nothing like a comet at all. Now, while medieval drawing could be a little bit wonky, and you should see some of the elephants they drew, this is way out of line. Okay, so maybe this is someone trying to draw a comet after second or third-hand accounts, like the weird elephants before, but they seem to get the headings okay. But a lot of ancient drawings are descriptions like that, and it may be that the superstitions dominated how the comets were represented. Until about the 16th century, comets were usually considered bad omens of death of kings or noblemen or coming catastrophes, or even attacks, interpreted as attacks by heavenly beings against terrestrial inhabitants. So in ancient European art, comets were sometimes depicted as arrows or swords in the skies, symbolizing impending doom or major events, even though the comets don't actually look like arrows or swords. And burning beams turn up a lot, or torches. In one medieval depiction, the benevolent stars, the comets, are turning their burning rays on hapless villages in a sort of War of the Worlds style event. So the tails of the comets are pointing down into the village, causing death and destruction. Now, even the Chinese, who made meticulous observations of comets, showed them as weirdly spiky things, more like a cat of nine tails than a comet. And the Japanese called them broom stars. And you could sort of imagine some of the comets looked like brooms. And some Europeans tried to show them as vapors. There's one image of comet with its vapors with an almost psychedelic effect. So at the end of the 16th century, things started settling down again, and the bad omen ideas which dominated begin to fade away. And then we have Tycho Brahe in 1577. He draws comets and their tails as moderns do, and showing the comet's tail pointing away from the sun as it swings around the sun. Interestingly, the Chinese, who drew the weird spiky comet tails, were the first to recognize that comet tails always pointed away from the sun. And then Newton showed the tails in a more modern fashion. And then artists began to depict them as we are now familiar with through photographs. And there's some beautiful paintings from about 1857 showing a comet looking very much like Hale-Bopp in the sky. So even though the drawing of comets finally became more like a comet really appeared. The hype, Devil Comet, didn't go away.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the astrophotography challenge. Now, I mentioned that Comet 12P is getting higher in the sky, and this means that it's going to become easier to photograph because it's getting into darker skies, but it's also getting fainter. Now, if you remember the best of the challenge, we got decent shots by stacking images, and you're going to need this. But if you have using an ordinary camera and you've got a zoom feature, try zooming in about 2x or 3x and use multiple 1 second exposure to ISO 320. I've used stacks of 10 and stacks of 20. Much lower ISOs probably won't work too much, but you do have to wait until the sky is a little bit darker, because at least for Deep Sky Stacker, you need several stars visible for it to stack accurately. Otherwise, we'll just come back at you and say, zero frame stacked, and you go, oh, okay. Yeah. Now, the problem is that there's not going to be too many guide stars, good guide stars, until relatively late. But when it gets close to Orion, you've got first Bellatrix and then Rigel, very bright stars, as guide stars. And more importantly, you've got this beautiful iconic constellation. So if you can get an image that where you get all of Orion in with the comet at one end, that's going to look really amazing. So you don't, even if you don't zoom in that much, and if you're stacking a fair number of photos, you should be able to see the comet in a quite dark sky with a nice little tail, and you've got the glory of Orion spread out. So that'll be a really interesting composition. And you may have to try over several nights just to get the feel for it. So you just can't go out and go stick your camera, go click, yeah, yay. You've got to go out, plan, have a look at how Orion's looking, and try and plan your photographs so that you can get Orion and the comet in. Again, if you can zoom in enough so you can get most, or get Orion in, especially between 12 to the 24th of May, you should be able to get the comet moving up, going past the shield of Orion, past Rigel and the foot of Orion. And the important thing is not only to get the comet, which will be really beautiful itself, but to try and get this composition of the comet and the constellation together. And that will be the challenge, to get that good composition.
That sounds perfect for a beginner like me, Ian.
And even if you don't get the comet very well, if you can get Orion nicely framed in your photograph, that will be really cool.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Ian Astroblog Musgrove. It looks like May is going to be a fantastic month. And thank you also for a very challenging but doable challenge.
I hope so. I wish everyone success and clear skies. And the good thing about the astrophotography challenge, if you cloud it out one or two nights, it's still going to be there for the next couple of nights. So it'll be quite good. Now, I didn't choose the Edo Aquarians as my astrophotography challenge this month, because we're going to wait for the Geminids later on in the year to try and go through photographing the Geminids later on.
Excellent. Okay, well, good night, mate.
Good night, mate. You have a very good night, and sleep well, and may the stars twinkle upon you when you go out to photograph them.
Keep on looking up. Good night, Ian.
Good night, Brenda. All the best. Cheers.
And remember, AstroFizz is free, no ads, and unsponsored. But we always recommend that you check out Dr. Ian Musgrave's AstroBlogger website to find out what's up in the night sky. And in 2 weeks, we're bringing you a wonderful interview with Dr. Marcus Lower, who is a postdoctoral fellow at Australia's National Science Agency, the CSIRO. His research primarily focuses on pulsars, rapidly rotating neutron stars that emit beams of electromagnetic radiation from their magnetic poles. Marcus has just been the lead author in a recent Nature Astronomy paper using the iconic Australian 64-metre Parkes Marriang dish, and also the Monster 76-metre Lovell telescope at the Jodrell Bank Observatory in Manchester, and they reveal really mystifying behaviours of pulsar XTE J1810-197, and we'll hear from Marcus about how we have never seen anything remotely like this before. You'll love this new mystery. Keep looking up.
Radio Wave!